Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
White people across the Western world today remind me of the people of Russia in the twilight years of communism. They're all serving a huge lie. Most of them know it's a lie, because their own experience tells them it's a lie. But they go on serving that lie because they have jobs that depend on the lie. They are part of a system which holds together around the lie. They have salaries they could lose if they challenge the lie. They have positions in society that are tied in with those jobs. The more ambitious of them, that is the so-called elite, have their eyes on career promotion. If they buck the lie, the big lie, they can forget about that promotion, if indeed they keep their jobs at all. This is particularly so with people in the key sectors of society, journalists and broadcasters, academics, and above all, politicians, sectors of society who have the influence to decide what kind of society it will be, the people who direct national affairs. In communist Russia, there was more at stake even than that. In addition to all these things, there was state terror. If you refused to serve the lie, there was the early morning knock on the door. There was the gulag. David Duke and I and a few others have tasted a bit of this, but nothing like with the severity as tasted by men like Solzhenitsyn, heroes of the white race in Russia who really suffered when we think life is getting a bit trying for us. We have to think of the example of people like that, who some of them, they were sent to the frozen wastes of Siberia because they wouldn't kowtow to the liars. They were too proud. They had too much self-respect to serve a system of lies and corruption. And they endured that, and they came through, and they were vindicated, as we will be vindicated by future history. People spend their lives serving a huge lie, or if not serving it actively, serving it passively, looking the other way when confronted with a great injustice tied in with the maintenance of the lie, as in the case of Ernst Zundel, writing and speaking what they know to be nonsense, because that's what their jobs, their positions in society, their pensions, their ambitions, in the case of Soviet Russia, often their freedom, even their lives, dictate that that's what they have to do. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the lie prevails. The lie rules because it has power on its side. And this is a key fact which we all have to grasp. It's not enough to have the weapon of truth. We have to have the weapon of power if the truth is to prevail. Now, all this is pretty obvious. It doesn't take a genius to work it out. Our activity must be geared to the winning of power. That still has to be said to some people in our movement, here in America, back in Britain, and everywhere else. They are crusaders for the truth, but they don't relate it to the necessities of winning power. It cannot be said enough. Power is what must be won. First, just a little bit of power. Then more power. And finally, complete power. Activity geared to anything else is a waste of time. Now, here in America, David Duke serves as an admirable example of this. He geared his activities to the winning of power. He said and did what was necessary to win power. And he did win a little bit of power for a while. here in Louisiana as a state legislator. Now, this was an enormous inspiration to us in Britain and all over the world. My party back at home, the British National Party, has focused its entire strategy on winning power. And we have won a little bit of power. Right now, we have 17 town councillors. It's tiny, but it's a beginning. And it's amazing how differently you're perceived if you have even a little bit of power. Let me give you an example. Burnley is a smallish to medium-sized town in Lancashire in the northwest of England, which suffers from the same ills as many towns and cities here in America. It's been invaded by the ethnic minorities. In the case of Burnley, mainly Asians from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. The whites have been dispossessed, and they're very unhappy about it. In the local government elections in 2002, our party, the BNP, got 3 councillors elected. Now we have 7. But then we just had 3. I was scheduled to speak at a meeting of the Burnley BNP in August 2002. When I arrived, there was a howling, smelling, filthy, demented left-wing mob had assembled outside. I'm sure you're familiar with them. Got some of them outside today, so David Duke tells us. The big travelling freak show. The best freak show in town. They were there to cause trouble, if possible, to stop the meeting. To keep order were plenty of police. Now, in the past, we've often felt we had a raw deal from the police. We were the people keeping within the law, and our opponents were the ones intent on breaking the law. Yet very often, the police were as heavy on us as they were on our opponents. But on this particular night, the police treated us with respect and courtesy and friendliness. And they dealt with the red rabble thoroughly and efficiently. What had made the difference? We had 3 local councillors. That's what made the difference. We had a little bit of power. And the police knew that we only had that power because a lot of local people supported us. And David Duke reminded me of this in the last couple of evenings when he and I and some others went for a meal in the town, and the 2 places that David Duke came, once they saw him coming through the door, that was it. We got the red carpet treatment because he has masses of supporters here in New Orleans, masses of them. Now, that's not just because David Duke is a very nice fellow, which he is, of course, but it's also because he's shown power. He doesn't have it right at the moment, but he still has this big following in the background, and he could get it again. Power. My point, which I can't hammer home often enough, is that the appeal of an idea, whatever its merits in terms of common sense, is multiplied 10 times over if behind it there's power, even just a little bit of power. Now let's turn from the obvious to the not so obvious. I'm going to talk about the question that occupies us all. We know that we're right and that the idea of race equality is wrong. Indeed, not only the idea of race equality, but the whole of the liberal consensus which goes with it is wrong. But still, millions of our fellow countrymen and women go on passively, if not actively, supporting race equality and the liberal consensus. They vote for the politicians representing that consensus. And we rack our brains trying to think of new ideas, new techniques of public relations, new ways of appealing to people to break this consensus. And here is where some of us commit a cardinal error. Some of us latch on to the seductive theory that if the masses are not yet voting for us, it's because we don't present our ideas softly enough, gently enough, because we're a bit too uncompromising, because perhaps we're even a little bit too honest. Wrap our ideas up in a gentler packaging. Modify them a little. Tell a little less than the truth. Introduce a little compromise. Don't put it over all too harshly. And hey presto, those millions who were frightened to support us in the past will now support us. We'll appear sweet and reasonable, and they won't be able to resist our appeal. Ladies and gentlemen, all this is an illusion, and it's a tragic illusion. It doesn't work.
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. You're listening to Episode 2 of John Tyndall, The 11th Hour. Before I go into The 11th Hour, I'd like to read some of an article on Spearhead in 2004. The article by John Tyndall is called Wrong Priorities, Wrong Results. The reason I read this now is that the European elections are coming around next year, and political parties all over Europe are currently starting to campaign, raise funds, and organise for the European elections. In this article, John Tyndall discusses the pros and cons of standing in the European elections. 5 years ago, just after the Euro elections of 1999, and while I was still chairman of the British National Party, I convened a conference of top party officials to discuss the outcome of those elections and the lessons they had provided for us. High on the agenda of this conference was the proposition that fighting for seats in Europe, though it had brought us some very welcome spin-offs in publicity and recruitment, had not repaid the huge investment the party had made in money and effort, and that we should seriously consider abandoning Euro elections for the foreseeable future. For myself, I was about 95% convinced in this view, but I wanted to hear the opinions of others before incorporating it firmly into party policy. From the very beginning, I have not been among the most ardent enthusiasts in the party for contesting Euro elections, but I had been persuaded by others that we should give it a try. Both principle and expediency had governed my thinking on this. In principle, the BNP should decline to recognise the legitimacy of the European Parliament, which it might have appeared to be doing by taking part in European elections. Against this was the view that by contesting elections to the Parliament, provided we did so on a sufficient scale, we could obtain the benefits of TV time and the postal distribution of vast numbers of election leaflets that would get across our policy for quitting the EU and serve as an excellent means of recruitment. It was a view that merited strong consideration. But this view, the expedient view, seems strongly balanced by an alternative view, also based on expediency. This was that the sections of the British public accustomed to support the BNP on issues like immigration would not necessarily do so on Europe, even if, as was far from certain, they were sufficiently motivated for the European issue even to bother to vote at all. The UKIP factor. Added to this was the fact that in the Euro political arena, we would be opposed by the United Kingdom Independence Party, which would probably appeal to a wider section of the Eurosceptic voters than we could. In other words, in contesting Euro elections, we would be fighting at a decided disadvantage in relation to UKIP. In elections where immigration was a major issue, we would be fighting on a battleground favourable to ourselves. In those where the main issue was Europe, we would be fighting on the ground favourable to UKIP. So it transpired in the 1999 Euro elections, in which UKIP won 3 seats and the BNP none. I approved the decision to contest the Euro elections in 1999 because it was something that had not been tried, and that it never been tried there would forever have lingered in the party the feeling that we had forfeited an opportunity from which we might have derived a massive benefit. But in the outcome, I came to believe that the benefit, though not to be derided, did not justify the mammoth effort we had put into those elections. I put this matter up for debate in the party and waited to receive some feedback. But then events overtook us. I was replaced as party leader, and my part in the debate, if there was any, was at an end. I changed my opinions on Euro elections very slightly as a result of the great successes the BNP enjoyed in the northwest of England in the general election of 2001 and the local government elections in 2002 and 2003. Because of these, I felt that we should contest the Euro seats in the region and maybe two others, as there seemed the possibility of a return that could send one BNP candidate to the Euro Parliament. However, I never entertained the wildly optimistic expectations of success that were expressed in official party publications, which projected onto the Northwest region as a whole the excellent votes we had received in just a few small number of areas. This very cautious viewpoint of mine, as discussed privately with some close friends and associates in the party, and there was general agreement on it among us, some of them not even entertaining my hope that we might get one candidate elected in the Northwest. We did not bring this viewpoint to general notice within the party, as it would no doubt have invited the accusation that we were putting a damper on things and undermining members' morale and resolve. We quietly kept our own counsel and waited to see whom events would prove to be right. One factor which contributed to our caution was the certainty that UKIP would be contesting the Euro elections everywhere, including the northwest of England, and that party would make considerable inroads into our support. At that time, we did not anticipate the tremendous surge that UKIP would make in the last weeks of the Euro election campaign, with a huge publicity drive backed by financial sources way out of our league, with big mass media coverage, and with several popular celebrities jumping on board. This clearly was not foreseen either by the present BNP leadership, and we do not hold them to blame for this. But what the leadership should have foreseen from the very beginning, based on our 1999 experience, was that Euro elections did not provide favourable ground for a massive commitment of money and effort by them and by the BNP, particularly with UKIP as rivals in the field, as it was always certain they would be. Local government elections should have been priority. Where the favourable ground did undoubtedly exist was the arena of elections to local government all over England and Wales. It was on this ground that the BNP had consistently done well and consistently performed better than UKIP. There existed huge opportunities for it to build on this success and win many more seats this year, but it required that overwhelming priority be given to local government elections and the relatively minor commitment to Euro elections, with far fewer regions contested. But instead, the party leadership decided on the very reverse. The overwhelming priority was given to the Euro elections, while local government elections came off second best by a long way. A hugely ambitious fundraising campaign was launched to pay for the fielding of Euro candidates in every region of mainland Britain, and a great deal of money was raised due to the magnificent sacrifices of great numbers of party supporters, who had been persuaded that these sacrifices were worthwhile. Had even half of this money been devoted to enabling the party to make a strong challenge in local government elections, with a higher volume of literature output, with posters and many other election aids, that challenge would have been immensely strengthened. In the end, the party emerged with no Euro seats, and just four council seats more than it had had previous to these elections. But in many areas, BNP candidates came so close to winning that that extra money could well have tipped scales between defeat and victory. Out of focus. And that is not all. Money aside, the focus of the party's leadership was so heavily tipped towards the Euro elections that, again, local government elections came off second best. Everywhere we relied on energy and initiative to be shown by local leaders, who simply did not receive the backing and encouragement from the top that they should have done. Considering this, their efforts were highly praiseworthy, Particular praise must be given to the efforts made in Bradford, where 4 councillors were elected, and in Epping Forest, where 3 BNP candidates got in. Doubtless party spin doctors will make a big issue out of the fact that one of these 3 was a Jewish candidate, Mrs. Pat Richardson. However, 2 other candidates, non-Jewish, were also successful, and it is fair to say that it was the well-organised local campaign, rather than the identity of one of the candidates, that was decisive in his poll. The party did not, in the end, get the hoped-for councillor on the Greater London Authority. Here the UKIP intervention was a handicap. 2 UKIP candidates were elected. The party leadership was not to blame for the UKIP factor here, as it was in the case of the Euro elections, but it stands to be indicted for putting less effort into the GLA than it should have done. We know of cases of London activists being diverted to campaigns outside the metropolis when just that bit more effort there could have tipped the scales between the 4.7% we received and the 5+% that might have won us one seat. One factor that was trotted out as justification for the excessive commitment to the European elections was the massive Euro payroll. The obscene salaries and allowances doled out to MEPs with the obvious intention of making them compliant and ready to put their jobs before their countries. It was proclaimed to the BNP membership that the party would reap massive benefits from this bounty by way of its own MPs making over 40% of their earnings to party funds, an allocation which would still have left them with incomes only dreamt of by the vast majority of the party. I'm just going to read that a bit again. So what John Tyndall's saying is, it was proclaimed to the BNP's membership that the party would reap massive benefits from this bounty by way of its own MEPs making over 40% of their earnings to party funds. And as he rightly says, even if that happened, there would still be a large income left over for the person. Obviously that didn't happen later on in 2009 when we did get MEPs. There have been some in the party who have maintained that it was this expected financial bonanza, rather than any rational calculation of political benefits, that shaped the decision to go flat out for the Euro seats, rather than concentrate more resources on getting councillors elected. This will probably forever remain a bone of contention in party circles. But at the end of the day, the proof of the pudding must be found in the eating, and those who determine party strategy in the 2004 elections must be judged by the results obtained. The big Euro payola did not materialise because the seats were not won. The rest becomes academic. When the BNP was scoring spectacular election successes in 01, 02 and 03, we maintained in this journal that this was due to remarkable climatic changes in public opinion, not to various policy and presentational gimmicks adopted by the party. We added, of course, that much credit had to go to local organisers and activists in successful areas who had fought intelligent and energetic campaigns. We must be consistent with this principle and acknowledge that disappointments in last month's elections cannot be laid entirely at the door of the party leadership and blamed on its various gimmicks, which I have always maintained have made no difference one way or the other to electoral performance. This time, climatic conditions were less favourable to the BNP than in the past, and the tremendous build-up given by the media to UKIP, allied to its lavishly financed publicity campaign, undoubtedly contributed to this. The BNP will have also suffered from increased public hatred of the Blair government, particularly in connection with Iraq, and the desire to deliver a blow against it by any means available. These factors most affected our party in the Euro elections, but they did have consequences elsewhere, which were outside our own control, notably in London. Nevertheless, the disastrous decision to throw the preponderant weight of BNP resources behind the drive to win seats in Europe will still be accounted the main factor in last month's frustrated efforts. This factor, unlike some others, was within the party's control, and it badly failed to get its priorities right. In particular, it failed to concentrate more effort in those wards where existing council seats were being defended, with the result that a number were lost. So he's talking about there where the BNP had won local seats, there was not much effort to defend them. There was kind of a thinking that you've got someone elected and that's it, but a lot of the time the seats were just lost. You get them, you have them for 4 years and then they're lost again. There is an interesting aside to all this. The UKIP leadership, no doubt under pressure from the party's grassroots, altered its former policy of refusing to face the immigration issue and came out with a watered-down manifesto for controlling the immigration influx. With recent trimming of BNP immigration and race policies, together with the fielding of a Jewish candidate and the inclusion of a Sikh in a BNP election broadcast, the consequence was very little clear water on this key national issue between the BNP and UKIP. What it amounted to was that where immigration was concerned, UKIP was permitted to steal most of the BNP's clothes. If the public wanted a half-baked policy for dealing with immigration, shorn of any mention of the racial factor, it was presented with a much more attractive one in UKIP's case, backed as this was by a high-powered and amply financed PR machine, rather than the shoestring budget on which the BNP was forced to operate. This was unintelligent politics, coming from people who are constantly lecturing us all on intelligent politics. The future. We should end this sobering analysis on a note of optimism. The BNP has missed big opportunities in these recent elections due to foolish strategies, but its overall percentages of the vote have been impressive. The political landscape has not greatly changed from what it was when we shook the nation by our successes last year. There is still a tremendous tide flowing against the globalist establishment and in favour of nationalism. That establishment has emerged much weaker from these elections than it was previously. Our opportunities are correspondingly much greater than they were previously. If there is any chance in the landscape at all, it is a change that favours us in the times to come. We should remember another thing from the 1999 Euro elections. Although UKIP got 3 MEPs elected, it didn't do them much good in political terms. Within a year, they were convulsed by internal quarrels, as was predictable in a party with no ideological backbone, lacking in strong leaders and full of people looking for a political quick fix. But we need to learn some very fundamental lessons from our own wasted opportunities of 2004. There must be a serious debate within the party over where we are going to go from here, and that debate must not be stifled by the many totalitarians among us who view criticism of party decisions as treason to the party itself. The activists who have worn out footwear trudging the streets in recent campaigns, and the donors who have dug deep into their pockets to meet hugely ambitious financial targets, have a lot of questions to ask. They are entitled to be listened to, and now is the time for this process to begin. That's the end of that article on Spearhead named Wrong Priorities, Wrong Results. Currently, the National Front has decided not to stand in the Euro elections, and the BNP are throwing everything at the Euro elections currently. So I thought that article was relevant, and I really do like the way John Tyndall, you can tell he's not saying what people want to hear, or he's just got so much passion and so much respect for activists and organisers on the ground. So it's good to read. It's good stuff. And now we're going to more of The 11th Hour by John Tyndall. Once JT decided he was to be a British nationalist, he pondered the history of Britain in terms of race, identity and former immigration. Ethnic threats faced by other nations was avoided for centuries due to Britain's geological advantage. Jews had come into this country in the wake of William the Conqueror. By the later part of the 13th century, they had generated wide and deep opposition to themselves and were eventually expelled by an edict of Edward I. They had returned by arrangement with Cromwell, who had become indebted to some Amsterdam Jews for financial support. By the second half of the 19th century, their presence in Britain had become an issue of some considerable political controversy, JT states. These migrations apart, no racial foreign presence became manifest in our country on any significant scale until the middle of the 20th century, when West Indian and later Asian settlers began to arrive in large numbers. If we are to go back to a period of our history in which a genuine spirit of nationalism permeated life in this country, we must look to the England of the Tudors. Then, not only was patriotic sentiment strong and national policy governed by patriotic considerations, but the nation was organized in a community regulated by certain civic disciplines, which included the strict coordination of economic activity in the service of the national good. It is perhaps not accidental that this period was one of the most creative and fruitful in our island history. JT continues, the coming of liberalism destroyed this harmonious fabric. We adopted as a national religion the concept of the rights of the individual, although of course this never amounted to more than a mere sloganizing for the effect, as distinct from the theory of such a doctrine is always that those rights, in quotes, become the possession of self-interested groups, based usually on the power of money and politics, and becomes a struggle between these groups in which national aims are lost sight of. JT then quotes Coralie Barnett in his book, The Collapse of British Power. Barnett, for half a century after Waterloo, the English could afford to ignore the animal lust for struggle, at least as being between great powers. A moral conscience was the ultimate luxury afforded the middle classes by commercial success and national security. Thanks to the war-making and aggrandizement of the past, they were able now to disdain and condemn unscrupulous self-seeking in other powers, just as the rich are able to rise above envy. The beneficiaries of the broadsides of Trafalgar and the volleys of Waterloo could safely indulge in their humanitarian and peaceable sentiments. In this atmosphere, JT contends, the British developed a totally illusory picture of the foundations of their success as a nation. These were attributed to liberal democratic institutions and certain ethical codes of moderation and fair play, whereas the true reality was that Britain had become the world's leading power despite, rather than because of, such traditions and habits. The essential factor working to Britain's advantage up to the first phase of industrialisation was that due to the nature of the various invasions and migrations from Europe that had occurred over the past two millennia, she endured the legacy of a racial stock which, in its combination of intelligence, physique, courage, energy, and creative talent, was certainly equal and possibly superior to any other in the world. Her racial composition, though overwhelmingly Nordic in kind, was diverse inasmuch as it comprised several branches of the North European tree, in its various Teutonic, Scandinavian, and Celtic subdivisions. This was not a racial mixture, as so often alleged, but merely a tribal mixture within the framework of a basically common race, an important difference. JT then talks of earlier public figures who could have been known as British nationalists had the term existing during their days in the public sphere. Foremost among British political leaders of the Victorian and Edwardian period who recognised the needs of Britain and her empire was Joseph Chamberlain, father of Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. That's the one who waved the white piece of paper. Consistent with his opposition to anything which might weaken Britain's position of strength, Chamberlain also became the main spokesman for the tariff reform, whose policy was to oppose free trade doctrines that were the prevailing liberal orthodoxy and to institute in their place a program of protection and imperial preference. Foodstuffs and raw materials that could not be produced from domestic sources would be imported, as far as possible from the dominions, which were to be persuaded to yield to Britain in return preferential entry for its manufactured products. British manufacturers would at the same time be protected from foreign competition by tariff walls. Closely interwoven with the theme of trade tariffs against goods from outside the empire was that of stronger political ties with its members. JT then quotes from a Birmingham speech by Chamberlain in 1902, which anticipated further dangers. Chamberlain, if by adherence to economic pedantry, to Ode Slibowefs, we are to lose opportunities of closer union which are offered to us by our colonies, if we are to put aside occasions now within grasp, if we do not take every chance in our power to keep British trade in British hands, I am certain that we shall deserve the disasters which will infallibly come upon us. JT also quotes Chamberlain in the Birmingham speech in 1906, the last great public speech that Chamberlain ever gave. Chamberlain, relatively, in proportion to our competitors, we are getting behindhand, And when the tide of prosperity recedes, and a time of depression follows it, the working classes especially will be the sufferers, and we shall find then that it will be impossible without a change to find employment for the constantly increasing population of these islands. The remedy is at hand. We can benefit them in trading with them while they give us reciprocal advantage in the preference which they give for our manufacturers. Chamberlain closed the speech with the words, "By a commercial union we can pave the way for that federation which I see constantly before us as a practical objective of aspiration, that federation of free nations which will enable us to prolong in ages yet to come all the glorious traditions of the British race. The union of the empire must be preceded and accompanied by a better understanding, by a closer sympathy, to secure that is the highest objective of statesmanship now at the beginning of the 20th century. If these were the last words that I were permitted to utter to you, I would rejoice to utter them in your presence and with your approval." So, basically, Chamberlain was talking about economic union. Not union so much as a federation with North America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. In other words, why bother importing things from outside the empire, say from China, when you could basically get everything you need from our own dominions, and then in trade they would take our manufactured goods, which Britain obviously was making a lot more of at the start of the 20th century, rather than Canada, America, Australia buying manufactured goods from anyone else. That was what he was talking about. JT continues, "Closely parallel to Chamberlain's ideas were those of Professor J.R. Seeley, whose book, The Expansion of England, published in 1906, incorporated a series of lectures on the worldwide dispersion of the British race. Seeley: "It seems possible that our colonial empire, so-called, may more and more deserve to be called Greater Britain, and that the tie may become stronger and stronger. Then the seas which divide us might be forgotten, and the ancient preconception, which leads us always to think of ourselves as belonging to a single island, might be rooted out of our minds. If in this way we move sensibly nearer in our feelings and thoughts towards the colonies and accustomed ourselves to think of emigrants as not in any way lost to England, while settling in the colonies, the result might be, first, that emigration on a vast scale might become our remedy for pauperism, and secondly, that some organisation might gradually be arrived at which might make the whole force of empire available in the time of war." So what he's saying is, what Seeley's saying is, the British birth rate continues to climb, which it was 100 years ago, then we should send people, British people, to Australia, America, Canada, and that way, rather than living a pauper life in overcrowded Britain, they can help build these dominions. Seeley, Tyndall states, was much preoccupied with Britain's then rapid increase in population. That this should be checked with the methods of birth control was unthinkable. Greater numbers of our race were to be welcomed as an augmentation of national strength. They should migrate to where they have ample living room. Speaking of the current trend of opinion in favour of jettisoning Britain's overseas possessions, he said, "Such a separation would leave England on the same level as the nearest to us on the continent, populous but less so than Germany, and scarcely equal to France. But two states, Russia and the United States, would be on an altogether whole scale of magnitude, Russia having at once, and the United States perhaps before very long, twice our population. Our trade, too, would be exposed to wholly new risks." These two visionaries, JT states, though their views gained considerable audiences at the time, did not win sufficient acceptance for those views to prevail. Smugness and ignorance, combined with the power of vested interest, in particular the vested interest of the great banking mercantile, combines which profited by the internationalisation of Britain's economy, prevented the adoption of their ideas as a national policy. JT adds, "In Chamberlain's and Seeley's time, the idea of a British race was far from unfashionable. Not for a long time to come were we to reach the lunatic situation where the championing of one's own race became criminal. Of all the proponents of the British racial idea, one of the most ardent was Alfred Lord Milner. If anybody's read about the South African War, the Boer Wars, a book about that, you'll definitely come across Alfred Milner. He was like an uber imperialist. He was the diplomat who was sent to meet Paul Kruger, the leader of the Boers, and basically Britain's argument was that the English settlers in South Africa, the Uitlanders, was not getting votes, and that was a big problem. So we met Paul Kruger, and Paul Kruger agreed to give the British votes, who was living there, and agreed to all the demands by Milner to keep peace, but Milner basically double-crossed him, and obviously Britain did declare war on the Boer republics. Milner wanted to build a railway from South Africa all the way to Egypt, which would have been huge, a huge, huge project. I'm not sure that was such a good idea for the amount of money it would have cost and what we would have got out of it. If you look at India, what did the British really get out of that railway? But then again, I suppose over 100 years ago, these people, they could not sort of envision what would happen just 50 years' time after the Second World War, when the empire was all broken up. Milner actually died from a mosquito bite in South Africa, ironically. Tyndall quotes Milner, who said, "My patriotism knows no geographical, but only racial limits." JT talks about Milner's roundtable society. He states, "In the eyes of some Victorians and Edwardians, however, the concept was rather a cultural than a biological one, taking in people who in the latter respect were outside the British and North European family, but who had been subjected to a British education, who had assimilated, on the surface at least, certain British habits of behaviour and professed loyalty to the British state." Gandhi comes to mind, who was educated in law in Britain. "In the eyes of many who've promoted Milner society, though probably not of Milner himself, such a definition sufficed, with the result that after the passing of Milner and Cecil Rhodes, another roundtable man who thought very similarly to him, the society ceased to be an organisation with a truly racial objective and became for the spread of essentially political doctrines that, quite erroneously, were claimed as British and Anglo-Saxon." In the later half of the 19th century, JT continues, "the first major threat to the ethnic homogeneity of the British people began to materialise with the entry of large numbers of Jews from Central and Eastern Europe. In response to this threat, there was formed the British Brothers League, which campaigned vigorously against the immigration in the years preceding World War I. At one time, JT informs us, the British Brothers League boasted members of Parliament among its supporters. It ran out of steam when the legislation it had fought for, and which was aimed to stop the immigration flood, failed to get through Parliament, but a not insignificant factor in stopping it was the hidden pressure put upon some of its supporters by the pro-Jewish lobby, which JT states, even then had obtained no small influence in British politics. Men started to find that their political careers, and sometimes their private businesses, were not enhanced by their opposition to this new power in British affairs, a sinister foretaste of what was to come in later years." As the 20th century got into its stride, what was clearly called for most was more than a series of lobby groups and pressure groups, but an entirely new and revolutionary political doctrine. The heroes recently returned from the front watched the politicians of their respective countries address themselves to the building of the post-war world, and were not impressed with what they saw. In place of valour, there was cowardice. In place of unity, there was division. In place of discipline, there was the collapse of authority. In place of order, chaos. In place of patriotic zeal, there was woolly internationalism. All over the European continent, new political movements arose which sought to grapple with these problems. In certain countries where the dislocation of life at the war's end had become the most acute, the very lowest elements of society had come to the surface and, taking advantage of conditions, had brought about red insurrection and civil war in place of the previous national war. Bolshevism had taken control in Russia. Elsewhere, Germany, Italy and Hungary, it was imminent danger of doing so. Indeed, it did for a short time in Hungary and the German state of Bavaria. Fascism in Britain never became the same force in the interwar period as did its namesake in Italy or National Socialism in Germany, and of course, unlike the latter movements, it never gained political power. The reasons JT gives for this are: the breakdown and crisis of Italy and Germany never happened to the extent in Britain. As mentioned earlier, the British were comfortable and had an entrenched attitude which was the product of liberal illusions. Finally, the powers standing in the way of fascism were much more stronger in Britain than on the continent. JT contends that a national situation different to those prevailing in Italy and Germany made it probable that such a movement would need more time to mature and become politically victorious. The onset of war put a stop to normal politics for the next 6 years. So what was British fascism and what were its objectives? Here JT quotes a left-wing writer who was unusually objective on the subject. He quotes from a book called Oswald Mosley by Robert Skidelsky. Skidelsky: the Mosley of the 1920s seemed to have all the attributes that I wanted from a Labour leader. Bold policies, unflinching courage, eloquent language, compassion, popular appeal. As the Labour government of 1964 staggered from disaster to disaster under an obvious inadequate Prime Minister, Mosley took shape in my mind as Labour's lost leader. JT then covers Mosley's political history, which includes being a rising Labour politician who had crossed over from the Conservatives and who had no, because they had no interest in mass poverty and unemployment in post-1918 Britain. Labour's internationalism caused Mosley to break from them in 1930. JT then quotes Mosley's resignation speech. Mosley then founded the New Party, which is some mainstream politicians of the old type. When they was heavily defeated in the election of 1931 and red mobs attacked their meetings, the fair weather types melted away. He decided to start a new movement with the hardcore who had stayed with him. The British Union of Fascists was formed in 1932. JT concludes that the Nazi-style uniforms and fascist salute may have been a mistake. Although he claims no moral authority, as he states he himself made the same errors with a group he belonged to some years earlier. JT stresses, in the matter specific approaches to specific questions, British nationalism must move with the times, just as any political creed or movement. On the other hand, in the matter of fundamental principles of faith, it is unchanging. What then are these principles of faith? In the first place, we recognise that the world is not, and never can be, one single human family. Such an idea is contrary to all evolution of the human species. In the real world of mankind, as in the world of other species, there will be, and must always be, competition for living space, for resources, and, among the higher species, for prestige and honour. As far as resources are concerned, these are finite, while the breeding possibilities of mankind are not. That there should be struggle between the various sections of mankind for possession of these resources may be an idea hard for some to accept, but it is an inescapable reality. The only question of the future, JT states, is who will be successful in this struggle and who will not. Nationalism simply arises from the acceptance by a human group of this law of the universe and its will that it should be one of those groups to survive and not one to go under. In the simplest terms, nationalism is no more than team spirit, just as at school, the firm, the regiment, or the rugby team. Each in its own way is infused with a pride of identity and a desire to win. So must nations, if they are to be effective forces for the furtherance of their own interests and for their survival in this world. Such a doctrine will of course be anathema to the liberal and left-wing intellectual. Suffice to say, my belief here is that at the bottom of this liberal and leftist rejection of country and race is a basic condition of mental ill health which makes that type unfit to face the demands of survival in the free world, in the real world. How is it, JT asks, that political opinion has been mobilised against the national idea and every powerful institution commanded by those who oppose it? How is it that a political faith, which alone offers a lifeline to Britain in her present era of desperate crisis, has become everywhere in politics, in the press, in academia and the church, the number one heresy of our times? How have the nation's political leaders at every stage of recent history steered Britain with a consistency that defies all logic along a course of national disaster? It is time to inquire into the question of whether our decline as a nation is the result merely of muddle combined with ill fortune or the product of some malevolent design. Leave it there for this week. I think that's a good place to stop. I will now play out with a clip from a Panorama programme. The title is Race Hate UK and it was broadcasted in 1991. Richard Edmonds again features in the clip. I've decided to have Richard Edmonds included because to not have Richard Edmonds included would be like doing a series covering Hitler's Mein Kampf without featuring Rudolf Hess. Notice that about 3 minutes into the clip, the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for the Metropolitan Police admits they, Asians, are covering petty criminality with the cloak of suffering racist attacks. What does he mean by petty criminality? Does he mean anti-white race attacks? Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion. See you next Sunday.
Tonight, Panorama reports on the return of the extreme right wing, the fight back by Jewish and Asian groups, and fears that the new wave of race hate could lead to yet more violence on Britain's streets.
In the East End of London, the openly racist British National Party take to the streets. The BNP want all non-whites to leave Britain. And they're marching in an area where racial attacks, mostly on Asians, have tripled in 2 years. Asians say it's a provocation that can lead to violence.
When the BNP come in here, they get the white lot hyped up. Going to have a march, and all the whites are going to say, yeah, let's go on the march. They're going to get so hyped, afterwards they're going to go out and look for trouble. Then the Asians are going to say, look, I ain't going to stand for this. Then they're going to get hyped up, and they're going to go out looking for trouble. So it's just, you know what I mean, it's just like a circle.
We appeal to local people to defend race and nation, to stand up and be proud of being British. Racism means long live the white race, long live the British race. We're proud of being racist, and we know that deep down so are most British people. It is, after all, at the end of the day, just common sense.
The BNP don't hide their admiration for Nazi Germany, and Jews, like Asians, are angered by their activities. The Jewish Board of Deputies see the BNP as pivotal in promoting racism, at a time when anti-Semitic incidents in Britain have risen by over a third in the past year.
With whites beating us up. So now, like, I mean, we're giving the same back to them.
As we're getting bigger and stronger, I mean, we're held together, you know what I mean? No whites can just come in and just, you know, give you grief.
The Asian gangs have got bigger, they got more organised. Now the whites are scared to come into the Asian area now. That's because of the Albion fault, not because of our fault. Albion didn't do nothing first. So now, we just hang around here, the whites come in, they know they're going to get, you know, stabbed, kicked, punched, whatever.
So if you got attacked, would you call the police?
No.
If they won't do nothing, you might as well just do it yourself.
What else can we do? We ain't got no one else, have we? The government, I mean, they forget them. They don't, like, to them we don't exist. The old bull here, like, they couldn't care.
The mood of the new Asian EastEnders was demonstrated dramatically in the events that followed a march in February last year that was joined by British National Party supporters. Among the marchers was Terry Sweeney. He was one of the standard bearers. Afterwards, he drove back through the East End.
Sweeney was driving down Ben Jonson Road when a brick smashed his windscreen. He stopped here and a fight ensued involving a whole group of Asian youth. He was beaten and stabbed. Later, four young Asians were charged, the Stepney Four. Among them, Malik Mayer.
In January at the Old Bailey, Malik Mayer was sentenced to 4 months imprisonment for violent disorder.
These gangs are, in fact, covering petty criminal activity under the cloak of defending themselves from racial attacks. We've had some clear evidence of that and some success in dealing with people who are yet to appear before the courts in cases where we've recovered weapons and arrested a number of people. I think, though, there is certainly a new generation of Asians in the East End who are Asian East Enders. They're not no longer immigrant Bengalis, Bangladeshis or whatever. And they are not going to put up with the abuse and, in some cases, the physical intimidation, perhaps, that their parents have seen fit to suffer in the past.
Racial attacks have led to a potentially explosive situation, one that coincides with British National Party activity in the East End. The BNP was formed 9 years ago, after a split in the National Front. Meeting in a pub in Bethnal Green, they explain their simple philosophy.
We want a final solution to the racial problems of this country. Our solution is repatriation. We want these people out, and that's why we're marching here today.
The BNP agree they are racists. They are not interested in nationality, just race.
What's your real aim?
To put the British people first, no doubt about it.
And repatriation?
Of course.
Including black Britons born in Britain?
The multiracial society will never, ever work out. It's not in the interest of the British people to have millions of immigrants to flood into our country. So, yes, at the end of the day, the parents came here, the children, the offspring will go back. Best of luck
to them. Repatriate those born in Britain?
Yes, indeed so, yes.
The BNP operate at street level, taking advantage of local problems and tension. This march was ostensibly a protest about the stabbing of a white pupil at a local school. The incident happened 9 months earlier, and a court has already thrown out a case involving several young Asians. The BNP refused to let the matter drop. They've held rallies and leafleted at the school gates.
We're sticking up the white people, right? And they can't just do what they like with us.
Isn't it true, though, that most of the attacks have been against Asians? Not against people. That's right, your arse, mate.
No.
Sorry? Oh, yeah. You're talking out your arse? That's what you're doing, you're talking out your fucking arse. That's what you are, mate. You're scared to cause trouble, you lot. Why are you here? Huh? Why are you here?
For justice.
Why don't you do yourself a favour and fuck off?
The BNP is not noted for its subtlety, but its tactics are having some effect. In last year's local elections in Tower Hamlets, they polled over 12% in one ward, over 9% in another, the best showing for a racist party since the National Front results here in 1977.
Our own race, traitors!
They've won votes despite the activities of some of their members.
The British National Party stands for law and order. Crimes like mugging, we will stamp out. Let no one be any doubt in that.
But BNP leaders have a whole string of convictions. How can you claim to be the party of law and order?
Very easy. I am very proud of my record. I have a record...
For smashing up a bust of Nelson Mandela?
Indeed, of Nelson Mandela, this communist terrorist who was imprisoned, and rightly imprisoned for many years, for putting bombs in railway stations. The leader of our party, Mr. John Tyndall, he was jailed under the Race Act. For what? For in his magazine Spearhead, in this magazine, John Tyndall was imprisoned for writing articles, serious, sober articles, about the problems in the inner city areas and for campaigning to stop immigration.
Jamal! When you're ready!
The police told us they've monitored the activities of the BNP very closely.
Have the BNP affected the racial climate in the East End, in your view?
I think they have contributed to a rise in racial tension. Clearly, if that organisation breaks the law, then the police will be very ready to deal with it. and are committed to dealing with that sort of racism where the evidence is forthcoming.
The BNP told us they have no policy on Jews, but they do admire Hitler and distribute Holocaust news, which dismisses the extermination of 6 million Jews as a preposterous propaganda fabrication.
Holocaust news is very, very important.
Isn't this a vicious form of harassment to the Jewish community?
Holocaust news is a wonderful statement of the truth. These allegations that millions of Jews were gassed in the Second World War, these allegations are without any foundation whatsoever.
The BNP has a branch in Manchester, and until recently it held regular meetings in this pub. They never said they were BNP when they booked the upstairs room. The meetings were secretly filmed and even bugged by a largely Jewish group linked to the anti-fascist Searchlight magazine. Last year, the group decided to go further. They infiltrated the BNP. Steve Tilsey, on the right, helps run the group. Taylor, he asked that we just use his surname, was the mole. Young and unemployed, he agreed to play the role of a racist skinhead. Under Tilsey's direction, he says he attended 8 BNP meetings last year. Taylor asked to be partially disguised when he described for the first time what he learned about the BNP.
Becoming blagging about putting bricks through people's windows and, well, mostly all Jews, in fact, was the targets. So they talk about things like putting bricks through the window, spraying things on the doors, posting leaflets through, things like that.
And was this official policy that was discussed by those who were holding the meeting, or just the activities of
just the activities of other people? One person said once, the Holocaust was an hoax, but let's make it real now. So you decide yourself how bad they are.
And the leaflets that were being given out at the meeting to be distributed, what sort of things were they?
Oh, it's things like this. Three-headed dog on.
Right.
Slapping him and things like that. Say things like, oppose Jew wherever they lurk by force, if necessary. Boycott their shops, their stores, business ventures, their newspapers. Most of all, boycott them socially, things like that.
But this is not a BNP leaflet as such.
Oh, no, it won't say BNP on it, but you get these at the BNP meetings.
Taylor says the leaflets were distributed not by BNP leaders, but by some of those who attended the meetings. But he claims that members of the BNP did ask him to carry out certain tasks.
I was asked once to go to Manchester Central Library, look at the electrical register, and make out a list of Jews' names and addresses.
Did they tell you what they do with these addresses?
It's just, the list is there, so it's got a list of targets, you know what I mean? Like, if you want an it list.
And they were going to do, what, sending literature to these addresses?
Oh, yeah, sending things like Holocaust news.
A BNP Manchester official, Alan Payne, agreed that Taylor had attended some of their meetings. But he refused to be filmed and denied Taylor's allegations. He told us, we don't do that sort of thing, ultimate responsibility for security. But the police have been criticised for not doing more to prevent racial attacks. When there's a confrontation, the police are stuck in the middle, as at this demonstration against the BNP selling Holocaust news in the East End last month. The police say tackling racism is no simple matter.
It's a very difficult policing problem to walk a tightrope between democracy and freedom of speech and allowing the use of inflammatory language which can incite racial hatred. It is a tightrope which those extremists are very well aware of and are very careful to walk themselves.
Black people have the right!
But if the rise in attacks continues and the victims lose confidence in the police to defend them, there'll be calls for a tougher approach. In this dangerous new climate, it's argued that action should be taken against openly racist groups.
I would like to see these groups such as BNP to be banned totally, because if we don't do that, it gives them an air of respectability that they are allowed to march and they have some say in it, and that the community at large accepts them, which is wrong. The community at large, the majority, the silent majority, does not accept them. They do not have a place in the community.
We have to make them responsible for their own actions. I think it's important that if you want where their members involve themselves in anti-Semitic, racist activities, racial attacks, that the groups that they belong to should have some responsibility as well and should be taken to the courts. In the long term, I think they need to be banned if they're not prepared to take that kind of responsibility.
With no law to keep them off the streets, the racists are growing in confidence, while the victims of racial attacks complain their plight is going unnoticed. Already there's a danger that self-defence could turn to angry vigilantism. Without more determined official action, the resurgence of racist politics could lead to...
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.